Everyone's given one special thing, right? Everyone's blessed with one special thing. I want you to know I plan on being a star. A big, bright, shining star.
Eddie Adams from Torrance.
Yep.
Jack Horner, filmmaker. I make exotic pictures.
In 1977, a kid from nowhere.
Maybe think about your name.
My name, yeah.
Something a little pizzazz.
Dirk Diggler.
Good name.
I like your name a lot.
Had a dream of getting somewhere.
Jack Horner has found something special in newcomer Dirk Diggler.
So let me just pop in this 8-track, and you just give a listen, tell what you think, okay?
It was a time when disco was king.
These are the ones. These are great.
Yeah, those are really cool. Are they lizard?
No, they're Italian.
So you like my shoes?
They're pretty cool.
Sex was safe.
Woo-hoo! Yeah.
Pleasure was a business.
Cut. Terrific. Nice work.
And business was booming.
And the award for best newcomer goes to
Mr. Dirk Diggler.
Wow.
Goodbye, 1979. Hello, 1980.
Are you ready?
But in 1980...
Come on, you puppies!
The party was over.
You are fired!
What?
You're fired!
It's jealousy, it's deceitfulness, it's vindictiveness, but, I mean, God, what can you expect when you're on top?
Wait. Love this part.
New Line Cinema presents... A portrait of two decades in the life of a business, the days of a dreamer, and the nights in between. Boogie Nights.
Hello and welcome to the Film and Water Podcast, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and our pal Ryan Daly is back. Hi, Ryan.
Hey, Rob. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming back. It's always happy to talk to you one-on-one. We're here to talk about 1997's Boogie Nights by Paul Woo! Thomas Anderson. Woohoo! Well, Brian is, of course, the big, bright, shining star of the network, which is why he's on here. Talk about this movie. Now, before we get to the details...
Actually, Ron, I got to cut you off. Like, in honor of this topic, I considered, like, asking you to call me by, like, a substitute porn name. But, like, I actually dedicated some time, and I was like... I'm not that creative in thinking of porn names. Like, I was racking my brain to try and come up with something clever, and all I could think of was, like, John Penisman.
Right.
And it was
but,
I was like, this is not a strength that I have.
Peter O'Toole? That's taken. No, I don't know. Yeah. As you might, for anyone who hasn't seen this movie, I'm sure you know what it's about, that it's a three-hour exploration of the porn industry in Southern California in the 1970s, written and directed by Paul Thomas Anderson. As you might guess, this episode is probably not going to be safe for work. We're much like the movie itself, we're going to do our best to kind of like dance around the subject, because the movie, for a movie about the porn industry, Paul Thomas Anderson kind of keeps it pretty polite in a way.
There's certainly a lot of nudity. There are a few good sex scenes in it, but it's like it's one of those things where you hear the topic and you're like, oh, it's a porno movie. It's like it's not. It's about people in the porn industry,
right?
And based on just that, like you kind of like show almost like behind the scenes type of like, but it's within the context. It's like it's not a gratuitous movie. I mean, it was just rated R, right? It wasn't like an NC-17 thing, right?
Right. Yeah, it's rated R. Yeah. I mean, that, in fact, I'm glad you said that, because that's something that I've run into with this movie over the years, especially in maybe in the 90s and the early 2000s. Now the movie's PTA has been around a long time. He's made a lot of great movies, and I think it's people realize it's like maybe a little safer. But when I would mention this to people, and they would say, well, what's Boogie Nights? Well, it's a movie set in the 70s about the porno industry. People go, oh, yeah, never mind. You know, you're like, no, it's not what you think it is. It's not celebrating porn exactly. It's giving you a sort of Robert Altman style, you know, history of the industry, but it's about the people behind it. It's not about porn specifically.
It's actually like I've thought about this before, but like in terms of the structure, it almost presents it almost like a biopic of a fictitious star of the porn industry. And like his ensemble, the people around him, the directors, the crew, and everything like that. Like structurally, it kind of follows a formula almost like that. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
I mean, it's loosely based kind of on the idea of what's his name? John Holmes. He was most John Holmes is called to okay. His claim to fame was even among an industry where large sex organs was sort of standard. He was beyond even that, and that was what was so famous for. And so that's what Dirk Diggler, which is slash Eddie Adams, played by Mark Wahlberg, that's his claim to fame. And he's the kid. He's just a kid, like a 17 or 18-year-old, living at home with his parents, not happily, as we will see. Mm-hmm. And he works in this nightclub, and he gets discovered by Jack Horner, played by Burt Reynolds, in probably the last great role Burt Reynolds has ever had.
He was nominated for an Academy Award for this one.
Nominated Award for this one. And he basically gets discovered as like, hey, you know, you can end up being a star. And, of course, you know, your acting prowess doesn't matter. It's more about your other type of prowess. Now, before we even get into all the plot and all the million things that go on in this movie, I do want to give just a little bit of history of it, because this is not Paul Thomas Anderson's first movie. His first movie is called Hard Eight / Sydney, which was a drama starring Philip Baker Hall, who was in this movie, and Samuel L. Jackson and Gwyneth Paltrow. And originally
John C. Reilly, right?
John C. Reilly, which is, of course, he appears in this film too. And what happened with that movie was it was apparently taken away from Paul Thomas Anderson, or at the very least kind of messed with a little. The title has changed. PTA wanted to call the movie Sydney, and distributors were like, that's too boring. We've got to give it a punchier title. So they called it Hard Eight. And basically, Anderson lost control of the movie a little bit. Now, as far as I know, the version that's out there, which I like, I actually like that movie quite a bit, is Anderson's movie. It's not like it's some, you know, they brought in Richard Lester to direct, you know, extra footage of it or anything.
Release the Anderson cut.
Release the Anderson cut. But apparently, Anderson came away from that experience very damaged, very, very wounded, as like, hey, what the hell is this? This is the movie I wanted to make, and it was taken away from me. So when he got the chance to make Boogie Nights, and he talks about this in the audio commentary, he had a meeting with the head of the studio that was going to make this movie, and he basically walked in with a bunch of demands. And he's like, this movie's going to be 3 hours, and it's going to be rated R, and it's going to have... And he's like, I don't want... And it's going to be called Boogie Nights, and that's it. That's the end of it. And he said the guy from the studio was like, okay, dude, relax. We're not... Okay, calm down. And I think part of the whole idea of, like, Anderson being worried about the movie title being changed is he tips his hand in the opening scene, because you literally see the title of this movie in the reality of the movie, like physical letters.
It's on a marquee.
It's on a marquee. You see the words Boogie Nights, and he did that so could not be cut. And this movie has one of the great openings of all time. Would you not agree with that?
No, absolutely. It is probably my favorite opening. It is amazing. It's like a weird subtle, because it's just black with like this kind of like slow lulling music, and then like a smash cuts to Boogie Nights on the screen, a disco electric song, and the camera pans down and we're like looking, and it's sort of like the swirly movement of the camera as it goes down from this marquee to we're outside the San Fernando Valley, 1977. We cross a street, cross a four-way intersection. We're just following these people, and we go into the Hot Tracks nightclub. We hear Louis Guzman outside, and he like welcomes Jack Horner and Burt Reynolds and Julianne Moore as they come. And it's one tracking shot that comes from outside. It moves like 30 feet like across the street through the doors of this club, and systematically sort of we meet in the same tracking shot through this nightclub pretty much all of our main characters. With like a few exceptions, they're all introduced in this one opening shot. We see John C. Reilly's character.
Reed Rothschild.
Reed Rothschild. We see Don Cheadle. We see Roller Girl, played by Heather Graham, and all these people. And it finally settles in a slow pan on, you know, boy face Mark Wahlberg playing just this 17-year-old kid busboy at this nightclub. And it transitions from the slow pan on him to Burt Reynolds watching him. And it's sort of like it becomes his POV as he's noticing this kid. And at first, it's kind of like this hungry, kind of predatory look. It's like, why is this older guy checking this kid out? But before long, you figure, like, he just sees this kid and knows, yeah, this is this kid. There's something magical about him. He could be a porn. He could work in the porn industry.
So, and it's right. And
opening. Maybe it might be my favorite opening of any movie.
It is. It completely brings you into the world, you know, of these sort of these crazy, you know, in this nightclub and going all the nightlife going on. And it's funny because what's his name? Mark Wahlberg seems sort of like a little innocent. I guess it's probably the last time Mark Wahlberg was ever going to be able to get away with that. Playing kind of an innocent. But then when Burt Reynolds, Jack Horner, introduces himself, immediately Eddie goes into the offer where he's like, well, if you want to see it, it's 15. And you're like, mm-hmm. What? You know, and of course he's talking about that the reason Eddie works at this nightclub, because we find out that he takes a bus all the way to get here, and he gets yelled at by his mother, Joanna Gleason, about, mm-hmm. Why can't you work at a nightclub around here? Why do you have to take a bus all the way down to Torrance? This movie's very much about the California mm-hmm. topography, by the way, the distances you have to travel to get places and stuff. But we find out that, you know, Eddie is kind of an innocent. He's a dishwasher. When Jack Horner says, why don't you come back and sit at the table with us? He's like, no, I can't do that. I have to do my job. But at the same time, he's there for the action. I mean, mm-hmm. he's making money on the side, basically showing his giant penis to people. That is how mm-hmm. he's making money on the side. The legend of his thing is so famous that he's got a side hustle literally going on, just either masturbating for people or just showing it off, which is kind of like a whole, like, who guessed that was a thing?
Well, when you're stacked like he is, it's pretty impressive. And he even has a scene with his girlfriend, which she talks about him, you know, before he really goes into the industry, when he's just kind of like with his presumably high school girlfriend. I mean, he doesn't. It's said that he doesn't finish high school. He doesn't have, you know, the kind of smarts. But like, she's like, do you know how good you are at essentially like having sex and doing it? He's like, well, everybody's good at something, right? It's like, that's just who he is. That's his talent.
Yeah, that's the thing he can do really well, and that's what Jack is looking for. Because as we will soon realize, that the porn industry is at a crossroads here, mm-hmm. because Jack Horner is coming from. I mean, we see Burt Reynolds; he's got like gray hair and a gray beard, so he's been around a long time, and he still regards himself as a filmmaker. You know, an erotic filmmaker. He has a whole speech about how his films are so captivating that when someone walks into the theater, even after they pleasure themselves to the movie, they still sit there in the mm-hmm. theater to finish, because they have to see how the story resolves itself. And that's what he's proud of. And of course, we're going to find out later that the porn industry is coming under the assault by VHS, by videotape, right, which is going to, in Jack Horner's mind, cheapen the industry. It's going to make it just kind of this ruddy, you know, low rent thing where everything's going to be on VHS and videotape, not film. I mean, it's one of the many things this film is about, is how these people see themselves as actors and filmmakers. And I think one of the best things that this movie does, and it, to me, it's very similar to The Godfather, in that it sucks you into this world, and other than a couple of brief moments outside of it, we stay in the world of porn where things start to become kind of normal. Mm-hmm. Where, you know what I mean? And when you get that moment where you're outside the porn industry, you're reminded of how weird this is, of how insular this world is. But once you're in it, you know, it seems so seductive, and people are actually relatively nice to one another. You know what I mean? Like, they're kind of, you know, in a weird way. Amber Waves, played by Julianne Moore, who seems like a nice woman but kind of half dead inside, because we find mm-hmm. out that she has lost custody of her son because of her career, and that mm-hmm. haunts her, and that's a whole other storyline. And like, when we meet Roller Girl for the first time, I have to tell you, did you see this movie in the theater? Again, you were maybe a little young for that, probably, right?
I saw it as soon as it came out on video. Okay. I missed the chance to see it in the theater, but yeah, no, yeah. I have a story about how I first saw it, but okay, I'll get to it later.
I saw this in the theater, and I mean, people weren't really ready for what they were going to get. And in that scene where Eddie and Jack Horner and Roller Girl go back to Jack Horner's house, and he basically wants to test the merchandise.
Yeah.
And he tells Roller Girl, come on over here. And she just turns around and she just says, so matter of fact, and again, sorry, this is NSFW episode. She just turns around and goes, are we going to fuck? And he's like, oh, yeah. And you're like, and then she disrobes instantly. And I remember being in the theater, people were like, whoa, you just weren't expecting that level
she goes to play a record, though. Yeah. She's like, okay, hang on, I've got to get ready. She turns on the music, and then she just takes it off and just, like, jumps on him. Yeah. And it's, like, so, yeah, like, how quickly she gets it. And he's just like, are you going to take your roller skates off? And she's like, no. I don't take my skates off.
You never take my skates off. He's like, okay. And then to hear Jack Horner talk about how Eddie is supposed to finish on Roller Girl, and you're just like, right. You're just not, it's just hard to handle hearing people in a movie talk like this. You know, you're just like, it gets to that idea that it's just so, this is just the coin of the realm for these people. You know, this is just how they talk.
Yeah. But I think, I mean, as you're saying, how insular and how seductive it is, I think you kind of, you get the impression when you see their outside lives. I mean, we really get the sense of Eddie's life with his mom and his dad. His dad is like their whole relationship. Like the first time we see them, you know, this kid, he's eating breakfast. His mom is like cooking eggs. His dad comes up behind his mom to like kiss her on the back of the cheek or something. And she just like pushes him aside, like disgusted. She's like, would you shave?
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
Holy. Like just like
the dad is completely cowed here. Yeah. The mom is running everything in this scenario. And she hates Eddie. She seems to really hate Eddie.
Right, she hates him for dropping out of school. She thinks he's dumb. She thinks he's a loser.
You work at a car wash in a nightclub. School never occurred to you?
Yeah, exactly. And the horrible thing. And, like, just this beauty. Like, it's a beautiful. Like, one of the things this movie does so well is the transitions, like, scene transitions from, like, one shot to another. But, like, when Eddie has – it's right after that scene with Jack and Roller Girl. He basically has this in, and he goes back home, and his mom is waiting for him. It transitions from a shot of Jack looking at him, kind of watching him perform for the first time, sort of approvingly like a sort of father figure,
yep.
to a transition to instantly his mother waiting at home in the dark, sitting in almost the exact same spot. And she just launches right into him as soon as he walks in the door. And he starts, like, crying and freaking out. He's like, why are you being so mean to me? And she's like, I'm not being mean to you. You're just too stupid to understand.
She tears his posters down. He's got his Bruce Lee posters. And she's like, you don't own any of this. You leave with nothing.
Yeah. It's amazing. And he runs off. He runs away from home with the clothes on his back. And it shows her screaming at him. And she slams the door. Cut to Jack opening the door.
Yep.
Of his mansion, whatever, and like welcome me in. It's like Eddie Adams from Torrance, come on in. And it cuts into like one of the first party scenes, and from there it's like, okay, he's got a new family. This older guy is adopting him. Julianne Moore, you mentioned, like, her whole thing is that she's lost the custody of her son, and all she wants to do is be a mom. And we see her trying to be a mom to Eddie and trying to be a mom to Roller Girl, and screws those relationships up pretty badly.
And yet those relationships are so confused because she wants to be Eddie's mom, but she also has sex with Eddie, which is that's not going to work.
Like, yeah, and that's actually – that is a crucial moment that I do want to pick up on. But then, like, instantly he's introduced to Reed and like, Jack introduced – like, to John C. Reilly's character Reed, and Jack's like, hey – like, hang out with Eddie for a little bit. He's a new, you know, boy on the street. And they instantly start talking or whatever. And John C. Reilly's ever, like, even has a moment. He's like, did you see that movie Star Wars? And he's like, oh, yeah, like, four times. He's like, people tell me I look like Han Solo.
Really?
Really? But, like, instantly you just see that. And for, like, the rest of that party, which is, like, a 20-minute sequence throughout, like, in the beginning of the movie, those guys are just bonded at the hip. And they become, like, fast best friends. And now, you know, now he's got surrogate parents. Now he's got a surrogate brother. And you see how these people become a family so quickly, and you kind of get the impression that Roller Girl didn't have anything else, and Amber didn't have anything else, so they gravitated to each other, and they support each other. And it's only when you step outside and you see Roller Girl trying to go to school and the way her classmates respond to her, knowing her lifestyle, and you see Amber trying to, you know, get her son back in a court custody case, which I love the fact – her ex-husband is played by a porn star, an adult film actor named John Doe.
Right, right.
And William H. Macy's wife, who cheats on him constantly throughout the movie, is Nina Hartley.
Nina Hartley, the real-life porn star. Yeah, yeah. And right, yeah. And we see that constantly, that when little Bill goes home, he hears his wife, and she's getting screwed by another guy. And the guy's reaction, he's like, that's my wife. And the guy goes, like, I'm sorry. And then Nina Hartley says, close the door, go sleep on the couch. And then she's like, don't stop, big stud. And you're like, okay. So little Bill is just not happy at home.
Right. And then Don Cheadle's character, like when he's trying to get a bank loan and the guy at the bank is just like, I'm sorry, we're not in the business of financing pornographers.
Right.
And he's like, don't call me that. I'm an actor. I'm trying to start a new business. I'm trying to do something separate. This is, you know, he's trying to open up a stereo shop or whatever. And the guy's like, I'm sorry, we don't want our bank associated with pornography. And he's like, stop saying that word. Yep. That's not. And he's like, so yeah, you see all they have is each other. And it is a great little family kind of ensemble in that way.
Yeah, you could see why they all fall together. Because it seems, I mean, except if you can take out the porn part of it, they all are relatively, like, kind of nice to one another. There's a whole other, there's another character named Becky Barnett, played by Nicole Ari Parker, where we see a scene with her and Don Cheadle's character, Buck Swope, which is a great Buck Swope, that he's the character from the movie Putney Swope by Robert Downey, the director, Robert Downey, who was in this movie. We'll get to that moment. It's one of the best scenes of the movie is with Robert Downey.
I didn't know he was in there.
Yes, that's a YP, not an MP. That's
he's the guy of the
Iron Man's dad.
Now you're talking industry language. I don't understand
YP MP stuff. I don't know what you're talking about.
My problem, your problem.
There's one point where Becky Barnett is talking to John Buck Swope, who was always trying new looks on. He's always mm-hmm. She keeps saying, she's like, I'm just trying to help you, Buck. And so, like, you know, because she's criticizing his new wardrobe because he looks ridiculous. His cowboy look. And, you know, we see that they actually are kind of this sort of really cracked family. And you can't – after you see the scenes with Joanna Gleason as Eddie's mom, you can't blame him for running away because she's a monster. She's just a monster. And there's – I want to wind back to that scene that you mentioned because it's amazing. But I love how for a three-hour movie Anderson is very, very tight with his characterization. Like, you figure out who these people are very quickly, which mm-hmm. I always like. And the scene where the mother is just being so cruel to Eddie, and she's screaming at him, and she's slapping him and tearing his posters down, and he's like, I am somebody. And she's like, you're nothing. And then we have a cutaway to the dad, who is in the bedroom, leaning over, looking sad, and we know that he's hearing all of this, and we know.
Oh yeah, you can hear them screaming through the walls,
right? And we know in an instant, okay, the dad is aware of this relationship, but he is powerless to do anything about it. And you're like, boom, okay, I get it, I get this dynamic, and we move on, and we never see them again after that. They're gone. They're just as if they're dead. But you mentioned the scene about where Buck tries to get the stereo business going, and you know the guy's like, we don't give money to pornographers. He's like, and you get reminded that that's the industry they're in. Because until that point, it seems relatively, you know, humdrum and kind of normal. I mean, there's the first scene where Dirk is on set with the rest of them. We hear off in the background this brutal piece of dialogue where Becky Barnett starts walking off the set. And we hear Jack Horner say, where are you going? And she's like, I have to – she goes, I got to wash my vagina. And Jack Horner says something like, well, have me back. And she's like, you want to clean, don't you? And you're just like, oh, Jesus. And it's like, well, yeah, I mean, you know, for these people, that's their day-to-day existence is that kind of stuff. You know, I mean, it's just this kind of regular. And I love how much Little Bill, played by Mitch Macy, is kind of the guy who has to, he doesn't get to do any of the fun stuff. He's the one worried about the size of the camera, the film they have to get. And, of course, we have Ricky Jay, the great Ricky Jay, as the cinematographer the who takes this way too seriously because he wants to give each film its own lighting scheme. And it's like, nobody gives a shit. This is a porno. Stop it.
But you also then, like, going back to that scene when Jack is first laying on his pitch about, like, the type of filmmaker he sees himself and what he envisions for this thing, you know, once – you know, Dirk kind of comes into himself and he comes up with this idea for their James Bond type of series with Brock Landers, heroic spy adventure hero character. And they're making this movie, the first one of the Brock Landers series. It shows in the editing room with Jack sitting over Ricky Jay's thing and they're editing it. And Ricky's like, it's a real film, Jack. What? And Jack is just like, it feels good. This is the film I want them to remember me by. And it's like, it's so easy to just put them down, but when you see the love and how they feel about what their work, I mean, this is an art for them. It's just, it's a different standard, but they love it. It's so, it's, yeah.
I like that Paul Thomas Anderson gives us a couple of scenes of the movie, of the Brock mm-hmm. Landers movie, because he doesn't – he simultaneously – like, I agree. I think that he is sympathetic towards his characters. I always heard that you kind of have to be. You make a bad right. movie if you hate your characters. But at the same time, he's very clear-eyed because Jack Horner is not a good filmmaker. These movies are shit. I mean, they really are.
And you see the performances are so bad when you see, like, the film within the film.
Yeah, Jack is pretending that he's making, like, Last Tango in Paris or something, and he's not. They're garbage movies. And another thing I love that when Eddie, who changes his name to Dirk, which I love, I just want to name that, like, a cut glass or something. I just love that, Dirk Diggler. And I love that when Little Bill first hears about the name, he's going through the list, and he's like, and he's going through all the Dirk scenes, Diggler. And he's like, Amber and Becky go in the closet, they go at it. And then Reed and Becky, they go at it. And then he goes, who's Dirk Diggler? And Horner's like, oh, that new kid, Eddie. And you just, there's this pause, and Little Bill just goes, good name. Yeah, exactly. But I mean, I love the idea that how like unreal their lives become, where Eddie at some point becomes Dirk. In fact, he says on the set to Jack, please call me Dirk from now on. And right. Jack Horner's like, you're right, I'm sorry. But then at some point, Dirk becomes Brock Landers. Like, he goes so far deep into, like, I'm this person playing this person playing, that there's no person anymore. He's just a guy who, as he says, you know, fucks for money on camera. Like, you know, like that's his, he loses all sense of kind of who he is. And I think that happens kind of halfway through this 3-hour movie where, yeah, you start realizing that, yes, this life seems kind of seductive and it's romantic. And Jack Horner certainly has a nice house because he's out in Southern California and he's got this great pool. The pool scene is amazing. Is amazing. And in fact, Anderson cribs another shot from a movie. It's a Cuban film. I forget the name of it. I feel bad that I'm remembering. But he cribs this camera shot where we follow Eddie. We follow a girl in a bikini who jumps into a pool. The camera follows her into the water, underwater, back out of the water, and continues as the actors go on to continue their lines. And we see, like, the sky is blue. Everything is beautiful. You've got all these beautiful women in their bikinis, and everybody's partying. It's like, why wouldn't you want this life? And of course, you realize the minute you enter this life, it's not going to take long until it curdles. But in the beginning, it's so seductive.
Yeah, oh yeah, and that's where the kind of the thing is, like, about the runtime. It is a long movie, but you don't notice it's long until things kind of start going south in their lives. And that's why I said this felt sort of like a biopic to me, because I think this was the first movie. I don't know Anderson just caught like the zeitgeist, or he knew what was going on, or it was just so influential and inspirational, because it felt like a lot of movies that came after this sort of picked up on this formula, which is where sex, drugs, rock and roll, they're great until they're not.
Yeah.
and then you get, but like, just like the sort of character arcs and everything, because shortly after this movie, the Spike Lee Summer of Sam movie came out, which had almost like the same type of structure and story arc. The movie Blow with Johnny Depp.
And
then you had like a bunch of like biopics of like musicians, like the Johnny Cash one.
I Walk the Line.
Ray.
Yeah.
Ray, Walk the Line. Yeah. And then Ray and everything. And there were a lot of movies that just seemed to be around the same period with the same kind of structure and the same overarching meaning. Whereas, you know, they get lured into this lifestyle of music or acting and celebrity and everything. And they're just partying hard until the addiction takes over, and then their life goes terribly wrong.
Right.
The first part, like the party scenes and everything, like they are so seductive. And that's like the second good, really good tracking shot that Anderson does in this, because it starts with like, you know, like the colonel's driver walking through the back of the thing, and then it kind of goes to different conversations and it floats around, eventually following the girl in the bikini as she goes into the water, and the music, Spill the Wine, kind of like dilutes a little bit. The music kind of comes down an octave because we're through the water, and then it picks up again as she comes out, and it's just like Dirk and Reed just like practicing diving and everything like that.
I love how like gently competitive Reed Rothschild, who is played by John C. Reilly, hilarious in this movie. He's absolutely hilarious. How sort of softly competitive they are with one another. They talk about how much they each can bench. It's like, how much can you bench? And he doesn't want to say because he knows that that Reed is going to top it. And that scene where they first meet each other, which is, you mentioned the whole thing about some people say I look like Harrison Ford, Han Solo, really? That has my favorite line in the entire movie. And it's a quiet line where they talk about where they each work out.
Yeah.
And Reed Rothschild says, do you go to Vince's? And he goes, no, you didn't. You wouldn't, because I'd see you there. I'm there all the time. And then Eddie says, no, but I've always wanted to work out at Vince's. Which is like, yeah. What the fuck does that even mean? It's a gym. That's like saying, you know what? I haven't been to that Target, but I've always wanted to shop there. It's the same Target as all the other Targets. It doesn't matter. And it was
But it's not for him, because it's like from Torrance to the Valley, it's just a different world. It's
exactly.
A different people.
But that's what I love
that's
it.
Where he
that,
wants to be with the action,
that's
like you
why
said.
I love it. Eddie is so insecure that he can't just say, no, I've never worked out there. But he has to act as though it's an aspiration. And, of course, again, to him it is because, yeah, in this part of California, that's where the action is. I love that that line is just so – it's not a line anybody remembers from the movie. But every time I hear it, I laugh at it. I laugh at it so hard because it's just so funny. The idea that, like, there's this gym that's like, oh, I was wanted to work out there. It's all the same thing, Eddie. It doesn't make a goddamn bit of difference. But I love it. You mentioned the Colonel, played by Robert mm-hmm. Ridgely, who, was, of course, did – tons of cartoon voiceovers and was a personal friend of Paul Thomas Anderson's. Here he plays the guy who kind of bankrolls all these movies, and he's loathsome. All get out. I mean, he has the scene earlier where he talks to where he meets Eddie and he says, so here you have a giant cock. May I see it?
and then it's great because the camera just stays on his face, and it's like this frozen smile as Eddie like unzips and like shows him, and he's just like, why, thank you, Eddie. And he just kind of like looks off in the distance. And he's just like, that was awesome. Also, we're going to make a ton of money off this kid.
Yeah, oh my God, he realizes, yeah. I mean, and that's the same scene where the phone call comes in for Amber Waves looking from the little boy looking for her mom. And of course, this little kid doesn't know that his mom's name is Amber. They only know her as Amber.
Right, and her name is Amanda.
Amanda. So when he calls, and Luis Guzman is the one who answers the phone, and he's like, and he's looking for a Maggie. He's like, is there a Maggie here? And nobody knows who Maggie is. And the poor kid gets basically rejected. He says, sorry, you called the wrong number. And then they cut to what Amber Waves is doing. She's doing cocaine.
Yeah.
And you realize, like, oh, she's, you know, this is the cost of the life. She mm-hmm. she clearly wants to be kind of, maybe, or at least trying to be a good mother. She loves this kid. But look at what, you know, that's the big, we're seeing, okay, these are the cracks of this life. It looks great and everything is sunny and wonderful, but it's all going to fall apart pretty quickly. And we see Dirk, he wins a bunch of awards, a bunch of porn awards. And he talks about, you know, I'm going to keep making better films. I'm going to keep rocking and rolling. These films matter to people. And Melora Walters is in this movie. She plays another actress and she has a great line where she says, I've always wanted to work with him, which is such a weird euphemism. But then we do a quick cut to like a year later where Eddie has won another round of awards. And this time he just goes, thank you.
Yeah.
And we see now he's already bored. Like, it's already – the rot is already settling in.
Yeah, yeah. And sort of following the progression, I think everything is going great into this until we get to the party, the 1980 party. It's the New Year's party.
Oh, Lord.
Welcoming in 1979 to 1980. So many crucial things happen during this party that sort of, like, set the stage for, the downfall of these characters. It's amazing. I think it's the first time we see Dirk trying cocaine, and it's Amber who gives it to him again.
And she's kind of forcing it on him too.
Yeah, she wants to have this loving relationship, this maternal relationship, and we see him sitting talking to Melora Walters' character, Jesse, and they're just having this great conversation. And there's actually in one of the deleted scenes, if you get the DVD or the Blu-ray, like it actually expands on that scene. And he's telling her that he's never been happier. This is his dream, that he's so happy in this lifestyle. And he just like being with her. And then Julianne Moore, Amber, is just like, hey, can you come with me? I've got a surprise for you. And she brings him up to the bedroom and she gives him coke and they have sex and everything like that. And then I think it's the first time he's tried it, or at least it's the first time we see it. And from there on, he becomes a coke fiend, and it kind of ruins his life for the next couple of years. But also at that party, he meets Todd Parker, played by Thomas Jane,
who becomes an
instrumental figure in sort of like their downfall.
This guy—that's the kind of guy that spells trouble the minute you meet him. If I was anywhere and I met a guy that would seem as twitchy as that, I'd be like, I'm heading the other way. This guy is nothing but trouble.
And yet he has one of my favorite lines too, which is when he first walks in and Reed is like rocking Todd Parker and they like do like a high five. He's like, I thought you had to work tonight. And he's like, I don't dance Sunday nights.
Yeah.
he's a male stripper. I just love that line. I don't dance Sunday nights.
It's good to have some limitations, you know. It's good.
That's the same night, the same party that Philip Baker Hall comes in and starts talking about videotape the conflict with Jack and this like really bad conversation that Jack is like, no, I'm holding out, I'm a filmmaker, damn it. And then we see, well, he talks that game, but that's not the way things go. Scotty J, played by Philip Seymour Hoffman, is such a wonderful performance.
And he's a hangers-on. Yeah, I love that we get to meet so many of these hangers-on, because obviously Philip Seymour Hall, anyone knows what he looks like, he was never going to be in a porno movie. But he's a guy that wants to be around this action, so he's the boom mic guy, you know?
Right. Because it's right. Like, and the first time we see him, like, during the first party scene, he kind of, like, walks in, and he zooms in, he sees Dirk, like, across, like, from, like, 30 feet
love
away.
Love it for a second.
And we just get a tunnel vision shot of him, and the song You Sexy Thing by Hot Chocolate is playing, and you just get it. But it's, like, so at the 1980s party that night, he brings Dirk out to see his car because he bought, like, a hot rod Corvette just the same as Dirk's, wanted to impress him or whatever, and he, like, throws himself, and he kisses Dirk and everything, and he, like, tries to, like, get him, and, he, like, Dirk... is remarkably restrained in his
I was
reaction.
About to say, I really like that Dirk, when Scotty tries to force himself onto Dirk, I like how kind of nice Dirk is to Scotty. He's horrified. He's like, why did you do that? Because Dirk is not, I'm calling him Dirk, Eddie. Eddie is not gay, so he's bothered, but he's not.
He probably had no idea, no inclination that Scotty was.
Yeah, and he's not like homophobic. He's not like, he doesn't use like a slur. He's just more like, why are you trying to, like, we're friends, why are you doing this? Which I think is, again, remarkably open-minded of Eddie, because you're talking about this is like 1978, 1979, that he doesn't use any sort of slur. Because of course, you know, when you're living in the sort of pansexual world, you really can't get too judgmental about what people get into, because and I like that's something, even though Eddie is clearly pretty stupid and you know, very shallow. There's the whole scene where he talks about his clothes with his Italian leopard print designs and it's all idiocy, but I mean he's not inherently like a bad guy.
No, and even like the fact talking about him not being homophobic, like at the end of it when like Scotty's apologizing and everything, they hug it out. Like he's like not like so repulsed that he's like, don't touch me, don't be near me, whatever. Like he still like wants to be. He's like, he hugs him. He's like, and he's like, Scotty's like, I'm sorry, I'm drunk, whatever. You know, of course, just like playing it off. And he's like, okay, let's just get back to the party or whatever. And he kind of like walks away. And Scotty does this horrible, sad thing, gets back into his car. And it's like an 18-second shot of Philip Seymour Hoffman crying, going, I'm a fucking idiot, fucking idiot. And in my mind, I close my eyes and I picture Donald Trump going to bed every night that same way.
I hope so. Yeah,
no, at least somebody in his family does.
Yeah, in the commentary, Anderson talks about that scene, and he says that like that was one of the few moments that like the studio was a little like, do you really need to have that scene in the movie? Because it kind of goes on a while. And he's like, yep, it's got to be in there. I think way too many of us can relate to that kind of feeling of just sitting there alone, being so mad at yourself that why you did this thing. And you mentioned Philip Baker Hall coming in as the guy who wants to talk Jack into moving into videotape, and there's this really horrific scene. First of all, he comes in with some of his future stars,
right?
And they all look like kids. I mean, they look like little kids. They do not look like grown adult, which is that part is scary. But
like they look like teenage runaways fresh from the bus stop.
When he says they are hot fuck action to the max, which is like a great turn of phrase. But he mentions something where he says, I like lollipops in my mouth and butter in my ass. Those are just things I enjoy. And for the longest time, I'm like, oh shit, that's not a metaphor. Like, he's serious when he says that. Oh my God. Philip Baker Hall has said later he wishes that Paul Thomas Anderson would put him in a movie that his grandkids could see.
I don't think we're going to see that in the next episode.
Probably not.
But then, of course, the last major event of that 1980s party, which ends the night, is the suicide of Little Bill. William H. Macy's character, when he goes through the party. And again, it's another long tracking shot where we follow Bill through the party looking for his wife.
Yeah, he keeps asking everybody, have you seen whatever his wife's name?
Have you seen her? Yeah, and he goes down the hall, and we don't follow him all the way down. We just stop, and he just opens the door, and you can just sort of subtly hear what's going on, and you just know. Because at this point, you've already seen her publicly cheating on him twice.
At one point, like, she was getting screwed in the parking lot, in front of a group of people, on the driveway,
yeah. Just surrounded by people, and she's like, "Stop, you're embarrassing me, Bill, go away." And like the friend, like the crew are just sitting there like, "Yeah, go, Bill, shut up, go away." Like, they're watching this. So at this point, you just know, and you just see him kind of slink off, and the camera follows him, and we see him going, and he's like, got a drink in his hand or whatever. He goes outside, back to his car, puts the drink on the roof of the car, gets inside, takes out a gun from the glove box. And the best detail that I love is he takes the gun out, like, loads it, closes the door, and locks the car again. And this is, like, for, like, automatic, like, keyless remote, like, locks or whatever. He needs to put the key in the door to lock the car again. And then walks in again. At this point, like, you see everybody else gathering around because it's the ball is dropping. They're counting down to 1980.
And nobody's noticing he's doing any of this because they're all busy partying, right?
Right, because nobody notices Bill anyway. He's just such a – just one of the characters. And he just walks down the hall with, like, the gun or whatever. And you just see – again, we don't follow him into the room. You just see him pointing the gun, firing, like, three shots, blood spraying on the wall or something. And, like, they don't even get to, like – it's not even time so that, like, it's exactly when the ball drops. I think they're, like, at 8 or 6 or something. And everybody, like, shuts up. And he walks back into the room, puts the gun in his mouth, and kills himself.
With a flash cut to a title card, 80s.
Yeah, right 80s. It's like, oh, okay, yeah, this is when drugs became bad. And this is when everything
is when it all got bad. In the commentary track, Anderson talks about that scene a little, and he says they went to a preview, and when little Bill got the gun and he shoots his wife, he said a bunch of, like, bros were in the audience, and they were like, yeah! And they were, like, really thrilled that, like, he shot the bitch, you know? And he said that he started slinking in his seat because he was like, that is so not what I intended. Mm-hmm. And then when little Bill kills himself, they quieted down because they realized that he had pulled the rug out from under them. And apparently he was with he was accompanied by Amy Mann, who, of course, he's friends with and scored his next film, Magnolia. And actually, you can hear her Till Tuesday song playing on Roller Girl's headphones at one point in this movie. But, like, apparently during that moment, like, she whispered in his ear and said, "Don't worry about it. They're a bunch of idiots. You know, don't get upset. You didn't do anything wrong. They're just morons." Because it was like, yeah, the scene is not about that little Bill gets revenge. The scene is about that little Bill has just been humiliated to the point where he breaks. Mm-hmm. And, of course, he kills himself. And that's – I mean – the scene wouldn't work if he just kills his wife. It's the fact that he kills himself too. Like, that's how tragic this all is. Is that it just, you know, the darkness is now fully here. And it really, that really is like the demarcation point. Cause you see everything just gets darker after this moment. Things just get worse and worse and worse. And Eddie starts doing more and more coke, and he's hanging out more and more with Thomas Jane's character. And there's even the great, we see that, like, when they're all hanging out together and Reed and Eddie and Thomas Jane's guy, and, like, they're rude to Philip Seymour Hoffman's character. They tell him to shut up. They're like, "Shut up, Scotty." And we see that, like, if Eddie isn't around Thomas Jane's character, he's a nice guy, but then he gets sucked in by kind of the more angry, coked up, jiggery kind of thing. And they're insulting to Roller Girl at one point, and you're like, okay, and this is all headed in the wrong direction.
Right, and then it culminates, like, with him sort of, like, first of all, feeling insecure that another guy is going to come, like, another young star, Johnny Wadd.
Johnny Wadd. Is it Johnny Wadd or Johnny Doe?
No, John Doe is a real – it's Johnny Wadd. So this character is, you know, going to come in and replace him. So, you know, he you know, freaks out. He blows up at Jack. Gets fired from the set or whatever. And from there, we just see, you know, the dominoes falling and all of their lives are taking the same. We see Amber going to a custody hearing, losing her battle to try and see her son.
You know, sobbing.
Right. You know, Buck can't get the loan. Like, there's a deleted scene that we find out. Becky Barnett, because she gets married halfway through and kind of, like, leaves the life. We find out in the deleted scene that her husband apparently just found out that he married a porn star and starts beating her up. And she calls Dirk to ask him, like, to come rescue her. And he gets in the car to, like, come and, like, save her. But he's, like, doing coke or smoking in the car or something and crashes his Corvette into, like, a telephone pole. Yeah. And then, so, like, we just see all of these things, and then it spirals, like, to, like, one night where a lot of sort of intersecting all, like, around the same time where Dirk is forced to resort to, again, basically what he was doing in the beginning before he was discovered, which is just masturbating for some guy who, like, picks him up on the street, who just, like, you know, is willing to pay him, like, $10 just to see him. And then that leads into, like, when Eddie can't even do it, he's, like, so messed up that he can't even get aroused, can't get a hard on. The guy, like, his friends show up and basically commit a hate crime on him. Like,
yeah, it's
like
a trap, yeah.
They're
a trap for him. Yeah, because they call him a slur word, and they beat the shit out of him. And we see at the same time what Roller Girl is doing with Jack Horner, where they are shooting, like, basically a live porno. I love that Jack has that line where he says, we're going to make film history, on videotape, and the way he just lets that word, and they pick up a random guy on the street and let him have sex with Roller Girl, which all goes wrong when the guy recognizes that he went to school with her, and they kick him out because he can't finish, and he kicked it because it gets really nasty. She's like, Jack, this isn't working for me. They kick him out, and of course, Jack Horner loses it when the guy says, your movies suck now anyway.
Right. I mean,
there's this great this great push in on Burt Reynolds' face as he just gets enraged and beats the crap out of the guy. And then the Roller Girl nearly splits his head open by kicking him
with the roller skates on. Like, and that's the thing. Like, Jack has been, like, punching this guy, and his driver and, like, the guards, they're, like, pulling him off. And then when he sees Roller Girl kicking this guy in the head with her skate, he's like, holy shit, she's going to kill him. They have to, like, pull her off.
Yeah.
And then all of this, like, sort of, like, this whole nightmarish night as these things are happening within, like, a half a mile of each other. You know, like, this beat down with Eddie or Dirk's beat down and everything getting, like, hate crammed in the parking lot. At the same time, we see Buck, who's now married and going to have a kid with Jesse, Laura Walters' character. They pull up to a donut shop.
That's an Buck amazing is getting, scene.
Yes. And Buck is, like just calling, like, ordering, like, a dozen donuts.
I love how sweet he is when he gets the donuts. Yeah. Did you make those for Christmas? Those are so sweet. I'll take two of those. Yeah.
It's so, and he's such a wonderful character. And then they walk in, and just as he's paying, some guy walks in with a gun to rob the thing, and he gets a bag full of money, but he's like, no, I want what's in the safe too. And you just see there's just one other guy, like a trucker-looking guy, sitting in the back watching this play out, and he's packing. He pulls a gun out or whatever, and he's getting ready, and Buck sees him, and he's like, no, don't do that.
Put it away, dude. No, don't do that, yeah.
And the robber thinks he's talking, like, to him, and he's like, puts the gun to Buck's, and he's like, shut up. And you just see this horrible nightmare shootout where the trucker guy shoots the robber. The robber then, like, as he's falling down dying, shoots the trucker guy sitting at his booth. When the trucker guy gets shot, he falls backwards, fires the gun off just at random. It hits the guy working at the donut shop, the cashier guy, in the back of his head. His head explodes, and just blood showers Buck. And just covers him in blood. He's wearing this white suit and everything, this pristine thing. And all three of these people just drop dead. And Buck is just standing there, frozen, covered in blood, horrified. And then he looks down. And, of course, we just saw him get turned down for a bank. Like, all he needs money to finance his business. The banks won't give him a loan because they call him a pornographer. And he looks down, and there's a bag full of cash. And he scoops it up, and he runs. And,
I think that's what the NRA calls a happy ending, is that scene.
Exactly. That's what I was thinking. I was watching this thing. I was like, yeah, arm teachers, because, you know, just give everybody guns and know everybody will be safe. Because,
see, good stuff happens like this. Yeah.
This scene. This is what you're looking at. So.
Yeah.
And then it's perfect because did you have something else?
No, go ahead, go ahead.
Because right after that scene, we cut to another card. He uses, like, sporadically, like, these cards. But right after, we cut to a scene that just says, long way down, in parentheses, one last thing.
Oh.
And you're like, okay.
Oh, man, this is about to get even worse.
Because you're like, okay. It's sort of like, really, it's like, they're not quite at the bottom yet. We got still farther to fall, but there's an end in sight. And then it cuts to what I think is, like, one of the best moments, or, like, best, like, extended sequences in film, which is Dirk Reed and Todd Parker, Tom Jane's character, come up with this plan to rob this, you know, drug guy named Ray Head Jackson, played by Alfred Molina.
You threw me the idol. I threw you the whip.
I think Raiders of the Lost Ark, Spider-Man 2, and this movie. I think this is my favorite Alfred Molina performance, more than Doc Ock, more than Raiders. It's just so they go to this guy's mansion because they're going to basically just give him a bag of baking powder, pretend it's a half a kilo of coke, get $5,000. Eddie can like fix his car and everything like that. And they just spend it on more drugs. They go there. Todd has a gun that's freaking them out because they're like, why are you bringing a gun and everything? Rayhead has an armed guard that has packing. But the scene, like you walk into this guy's mansion, it looks like it's out of Scarface. Yeah. It's such a like a Brian De Palma like moment or whatever. And you got this guy just in a bathrobe and a Speedo just partying. We hear Sister Christian playing on the music. And he has this like Asian houseboy, this Chinese guy walking around named Cosmo, throwing firecrackers.
I love that. It's constant snap, just, snap, snap.
Yeah, snap, like pops down. And because these guys are all high as shit and they're planning like a robbery or whatever, they're just every time like just pop, they just like jump and freak out like they're going to lose it. And it sets the tension perfectly. And then it sort of like culminates this moment like where after they've done the deal and everything and Rayhead is talking about his mixtapes. He's got an awesome mix. Star-Lord wasn't the first one to do that.
That's right. And he got them labeled. We see awesome mixtape 9, awesome mixtape 10. Yeah.
It's perfect. And we see them doing it. And then it cuts to the song Jesse's Girl. And as they're getting ready to leave, we again do this slow kind of like stop freeze on Dirk's face. And it's this really weird kind of enigmatic look, but it to me, I've always interpreted it as he knows how far he's fallen. Like he has this moment where he's like, this is insane. And it might be the fact that the song is Jesse's Girl and he's remembered because I went back and I looked at like at the 80s party before his life took a turn when Amber pulled him up to the room to give him coke. But before that, he was talking to Jesse, Melora Walters' character.
I
think there might be something to it. Like he's remembering that was the last time he was really happy. And everything that has gone, like everything after that, and he's kind of wants to get back to that moment or that life. Because after that, he just kind of snaps out of it. He's like, okay, we got to go. We're getting out of here. And that's when Todd is like, nope, we're not leaving. We want the money in the floor safe. Takes out the gun, sparks another shootout, which the first time I saw it, I figured Dirk as the star would survive. I was sure John C. Reilly was going to die too. I was like, everybody's going to die except for Dirk. And I was so happy that he manages to run off and just jump over a hedge outside. they shoot, like Todd gets shot and then he shoots the guard. Rayhead like runs into his bedroom, comes out with a shotgun, blows Todd Parker in half. And they're like just running around. And he's just chasing them down the street with a shotgun as Eddie's like diving into his moving car and everything. It's so, it's a nightmare. But I love that sequence. It's all about the music, the setting, and just those firecrackers, just that pop. Just like every time you start to kind of like forget where you're doing, you're just like jumping like, because they're all got guns and you know what's going to happen.
And there's all this kind of smoke in the air. Like it's just a hazy, kind of looks like a hookah den, you know, it's like a really scary place. It's funny you mention that because I always thought, not in any way to criticize Paul Thomas Anderson, but I always wondered if the final two scenes with Eddie, the one where he is basically turning tricks and then gets the crap beat out of him, and then the one with Thomas Jane and Rod John C. Reilly, couldn't be switched because I always feel like Eddie being kicked, almost kicked to death in a parking lot after turning a trick for $10, which he can't even finish because his body is so racked.
Right.
I always feel like that's him a little lower than the scene where he's robbing out from Melina. But I also understand that I think the Jesse's Girl scene, that I never really thought of it that way, but I think you're probably right about that. And also it almost dying at the hand of the guy getting shot is probably a little on the lower scale in terms of like how dangerous things were. Like he was really this close to getting his head blown off because he got caught up in this scheme. I mean, you get the idea that Dirk Diggler / Eddie would never think to rob anybody without this Todd Parker being the ringleader. Like he's just not that guy. I mean, in fact, there is one scene we had to mention is that the one other way that him and Reed Rothschild try to make money is their their recording career. And this is something where even the movie's 3 hours, I feel like Paul Thomas Anderson knew he had gold here and he just couldn't bear to cut it, of just this footage of John C. Reilly and Mark Wahlberg singing "You've Got the Touch" from Transformers. And Eddie is the worst singer in the world.
I think that scene would have predated that movie. I know. So I don't know why they picked the Stan Bush song from Transformers the movie from 1986. I'm pretty sure the part in the movie takes place long before that. I love the fact that, okay, Mark Wahlberg started as a musician before he was acting. You know, he was Marky Mark of the Funky Bunch. It was a spinoff of his older brother from New Kids on the Block. And, I'm not going to, champion his musical abilities, but he can sing better than he does in this movie. He's deliberately having a crappy voice as he's trying to sing The Touch and this other song.
I love that he's insulting the producer, played by Mark Penn, Sean Penn's brother, and the musician, about, he's like, is there not enough, I think the bass drowning out my vocals? And the guy's like, no, I think it's fine. No, I think the bass is definitely drowning out my, it's like, no, Dirk, it's your vocals. Nothing is going to help your vocals, man. And then, of course,
we speeded up a couple of octaves.
And then we learn later that they, of course, haven't paid the bill for the recording sessions, and they run into the record owner, which is the studio owner, which is played by the great director Robert Downey, the father of Robert Downey Jr. And he has this whole scene where he basically has to inform them that you're not getting the tapes because you owe me the money. And they are of course, they're all coked up and they're screaming at him about, they're like, we are guaranteed a record contract. That's how good we are.
That's how
good this music is. We're waiting for it right now. And Robert Downey has this whole great bit, which I still use in my real life to this day, about, that's a YP, not an MP. Your problem. And you get Reed Rothschild's like, MP, YP, I don't understand this Indian industry jargon. All I know is the magic on those, the tapes, they're yours. I admit that. The tapes, those are your property. But the magic on those tapes, that is us. That is our art. And it just, it's like, they're just so wrong-headed and stupid and yet passionate about what they're doing. It is one of the best scenes in that movie. It's just so
just sitting in the background of that scene is Philip Seymour Hoffman's character, just with his arms across his chest, like he's so uncomfortable. He just wants to be with these guys as Dirk is like ready to do, like he does his kung fu poses. He's like threatening to kick this guy's ass.
Yeah.
And Scotty J has to like just wrap his arms around him and like pull him outside the studio.
It's so fantastic. And so after Eddie kind of hits the low point, and he goes back to Jack Horner, and he begs forgiveness, and he begs to be brought back into life. And Jack takes him back. And the movie ends on a very sort of interestingly ambivalent note, where we see some of the characters have seemingly escaped the porn lifestyle. Reed Rothschild does kind of like this sort of sex magic act with a topless girl, which is sort of really funny. And then we see that Amber is moving into kind of being a director, which suggests the parallel life of there was a couple of real life porn actresses that have done that have moved from acting to directing. In fact, there's another real life porn actress who plays the judge in the custody scene.
She's
a real life porn actress, and she plays the judge that decides that Amber Waves is going to lose the custody of her son. But we see that Amber has moved on to be a director. She shoots a commercial for Buck's Stereo Store. By the way, of course, as the host of Gimme Those Star Wars, you have to remember the name of the equipment that Buck was trying to sell in the beginning of the movie.
The TK-421.
The TK-421, yeah. This guy has this extra level of bass. It gives you extra four levels of quad. That's technical talk.
That's technical stuff.
You'll understand it. So the movie ends with kind of a lot of the characters in place. Jack is still married to Amber. Amber is still doing porn, although it ends on we see that Buck and his wife they've had a baby, and the baby's there in the pool, and he's like, don't let that baby piss in the pool.
I don't think so.
And there's this brutal scene of Amber just sitting in front of her makeup table, where Jack Horner leans over and he says, "You are still the sexiest bitch in the world." Which
he says, "Foxiest bitch."
Yeah, foxiest bitch, which he deems as a compliment. Yeah. But then this sad music plays over her, and she just stares blankly into the glass, and it's really tragic because you just know that she's so unhappy, and there's no way out for her. Like, she's sort of doomed to just live this lifestyle until eventually there's no more room for her in the porn industry.
I like that. And the first time they go to bed, in the openings after the first night, when they go back to Jack's house and And Amber goes to bed, and he's like, "Good night, honey tits. Sleep beautiful."
Yeah. Oh, Lord Almighty. The names of so, and then it and ends. Then, oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was going
to. I'm just going to do the final scene. Is with Eddie back in a dressing room. He's back doing porn. He's got kind of a nice dressing room, so maybe it's a little higher end porn or something. Mm. And he's in his Miami Vice duds.
Oh, actually, yeah, he does.
Because he's shooting his Brock Landers movies, and he's rehearsing a scene from Serpico. He's doing lines from Serpico. So it's you've got Mark Wahlberg playing Eddie Adams, playing Dirk Diggler, playing Brock Landers, doing Al Pacino as Serpico. So we are like inceptioning big time here. We are so far in. And he's just
he had the Serpico poster on his wall.
And so we talk about that he's a big, bright, shining star, and he always will be. And then, of course, the movie goes full on as Dirk stands up, and there's a medium shot where we see Dirk from the waist down, and he reveals to the movie-going audience the thing we were all talking about.
One of the best prosthetics in the
movie. This massive penis that just dangles there, and he tucks it back in his pants, does the little karate move, little dojo move, and then slams the door, and then we cut to ELO's Living Thing, which is one of the great cuts in all of cinema in terms of scene to music.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, the soundtrack to this entire movie is wonderful. I highly recommend it. They released two different volumes of the soundtrack.
This thing is wall to wall. It's great.
Motion Picture Volume 1 and Volume 2. But yeah, like such an amazing begin, like one of the best movie openings and one of the best movie endings of all time.
I feel it says something about Jeff Lynne and that I read about that when Jeff Lynne was first approached about this. That they wanted to use his movie in the song in the movie. He's kind of like anti-pornography, I guess. And he was like, I don't want to be associated with that. And then they apparently sent him at the very least some of the footage. And he was like, oh, okay, I'll use it. Cause I think he recognized, oh, this is a real movie. You know, like it's not just like a celebration of porn. It actually is like a real, you know, like it was a good for Jeff Lynne. You know, he was able to see the quality here, to be found. And it's a perfect, weirdly upbeat song to go out on, with contrast against what we just saw.
Yeah, it's like deceptive again. It kind of like they're going back to what they're good at, what they know, and it's deceptively hypnotic. It's kind of beautiful in its own way, and the titles for the ending credits are so small in comparison. I don't know what it is about this movie, but the titles feel very small.
They're very oddly formal, too. It's like, you know, Mark Wahlberg played Dirk Diggler. Yeah. John C. Reilly played Reed Rothschild.
I expect, stars and everything, kind of, more vibrant type of, decorations on the closing titles. But, I was reminded of, one of my favorite moments in the movie, during one of the montages when Dirk is, first getting into the industry and kind of first getting good at everything, and they're blocking a sex scene with him and Roller Girl and Jack. They're kind of, walking him through it or whatever, and he's like, well, if she puts her leg up like this, you know, we can roll her over and we can go straight to doggy style. And they're like, yeah, that sounds good, you know, everything, we'll do it that way. And Jack goes behind the camera, and just before it cuts, Dirk looks back at me, he's like, Jack, do you want me to use a Spanish accent? what movie are they making? And the fact that they take it that seriously, again, it just goes to, this is their profession. This is what they were doing and what they had this idea of their lives that probably isn't what the rest of the world sees them as, but it's for them, it was so perfect. I love that. Do you want me to use a Spanish accent?
When Dirk gives the interview to Amber Waves about the biofilm that she makes of him, and he goes on and on about how he gets thousands of letters from couples saying that he has saved their sex lives, and you know, he's making all of this up. This is all bullshit. He has enough self-awareness to be insecure about what he does. You know, like he knows. And then John C. Reilly has one of the great lines of all time about how he does not buy the idea that porn contributes to the downfall of society. And he's like, you know, hey, if violence in films caused violence, we would just stop making movies. It'd be fine. There'd be no violence. And then the great line, I'll fuck on my own time, which is one of the great, I like to use that in completely non sequitur terms sometimes. It's just people are like, I fuck on my own time. This movie is just littered with great little bits of amazing dialogue, which give you insight to these characters. I mean, Amber Waves talks about literally while Dirk is screwing her, where she says, I'm fixed, which is a horrifying way of referring to
because
not being able to get pregnant
inside her.
Yeah. Oh my God. Just that, I shudder every time I hear that, the way she says it. And
which again, like that's again, so his Dirk's first moment, his first sex scene that they're shooting or whatever, he finishes inside her as she requests or whatever, instead of, you know, pulling out and finishing on her chest.
The money shot,
The blog, the money shot. And everybody is like, it's a great thing to watch because half the time that they are having sex, we're just watching the reactions of everybody else. And like the first time they disrupt, you just see like John C. Reilly and Becky Barnett kind of turning their
heads sideways.
Like wow. And like everybody's just wrapped up. Like Philip Seymour Hoffman is like almost like catching his breath as he's holding the
mic. Oh, he's like quaking and with sexual tension. He's so excited about what he's looking at.
And like when it, like when they finish or whatever, like even Jack is like so wrapped up, he just says like wonderful, and little Bill's like, I guess that's a cut, and then he has to kind of remind them, he's like, we didn't get the money shot, we didn't get that shot, and they're like, well, maybe we can go to like stock footage, he's like, no, it's not going to match, and they're kind of arguing about it, and Dirk just like so casually just kind of looks back, he's like, hey, I can go again if you need another take,
yeah,
and. We cut to a champagne bottle uncorking and like the foam spilling out over top of it. That's again why I love the transitions in this movie, just from shot to shot, scene to scene. It's like Anderson just knew what he was doing with that. It's such an artfully looking movie. So.
Every time I watch this movie, I think about a quote from Orson Welles, and I think I'm sure I must have said this on the show at some point, where Orson Welles, when he was making Citizen Kane, and he was introduced to all the different departments at the RKO thing where you could do the special effects, and then the mats, and then the audio, and he said that movie making was the greatest toy train set a boy could ever have. And I look at this movie, even though it's very downbeat and it features a lot of really heavy, nasty stuff. I mean, especially like the side storyline where we find out what happens to the Colonel is really dark, really, really dark.
Yeah.
But this, you can feel the sense of exuberance. That's the word I wrote down in my notes here, that Paul Thomas Anderson has for just making a movie. Like he's just so bursting at the seams with life to make this movie and tell this story, that to me you just get caught up in it, and it doesn't matter that it's this kind of dark, skanky world that you don't want any part of. You just watch and you're like, man, this guy is in full control of his art form. He's got me by the hand, if you want to use hand. He's got me by the hand, and he's leading me around through this world, and he is completely confident in the movie he wants to show me. And that is, to me, that's very exciting. He even leaves in a mistake. Because we talk about the scene where Nina Hartley, little Bill's wife, is getting screwed in the parking lot, and then
he screws up the dialogue.
He screws up the dialogue where he talks to Ricky Jay, and he's like, "What are you so upset about?" And he's like, "My wife is down there with an ass in her cock."
Yeah,
which of course he transposed the words, and he left it in because of course it makes total sense. Little Bill could mess that up. It's not a, you know, and that's how confident Anderson is in this movie. And to me, it just shows it put him on the map. People realize this guy, and he's basically never left. I mean, he is now, all of his films basically just like routinely get nominated for Best Picture. Phantom Thread just did. Oh, he didn't win, but nevertheless, like he became, with Boogie Nights, one of the preeminent filmmakers of the 21st century. And it's well deserved. I think every one of his movies since have been really interesting. I mean, people have said, I wish he would go back to make something more like Boogie Nights, but I think they want something a little funnier, a little lighter. He's gotten into heavier, darker subjects, but it's, and I wouldn't want him to make another Boogie Nights necessarily, because it's like, he make the movies he wants to make. He's Stanley Kubrick, you know, do what you want, man. Don't worry about it. But this film is just so teeming with life and energy and fun. And I never get tired of watching it, despite the fact that it is a 3-hour movie about the porn industry.
Yeah, but again, like the first 2/3 of it are really just rolling, and it's just so fun. It's vibrant. You can watch this movie for the music, for the cast, for the fashion, the scenes. But like, yeah, the cast especially. I mean, if you look at it, like who these people were, like in 1997. You know, obviously Burt Reynolds. Again, this might have been his last really good role, and he was coming off of not a lot of good stuff. But Mark Wahlberg obviously as the star, but if you look at like the other people, like Julianne Moore in 1997, this was like, she was just getting big and she was about to get much bigger. Heather Graham, just before she kind of like took off, for a kind of a short period of time, but she was like, and just looking at everybody else, like Don Cheadle, Luis Guzman, John C. Reilly, this was before he started doing like the Judd Apatow kind of like Step Brothers and all of those and the Funnier Die stuff. Philip Seymour Hoffman, just like everybody involved in this. You just look at the Murderers Row and this cast, and like, these guys are so good, and they're and they're all serviced well. Like there aren't like a lot of like performers or like characters that are really wasted in this movie. Like they have arcs, which is why like even though there's a central narrative, like the movie is big enough that you do feel the family ensemble of these people. And again, that goes to what you said much earlier with how tight Anderson is with the characterization, how you get to know these characters so quickly and you get to love them. It's a really remarkable movie. There are two movies that I absolutely adore, and I think people kind of like bristle at the subject matter and are turned off by it. It's this one, and there's a movie that I always recommend called Lars and the Real Girl.
Ah, right, which, yes.
It's Ryan Gosling dating a anatomically correct sex doll. Now, that sounds like a salacious,
yeah.
like rom-com or just like a horrible thing. Believe me when I say Lars and the Real Girl is the most like heartfelt romantic movie I have maybe ever seen. Ryan Gosling, Emily Mortimer. It is such a delightful movie. I recommend that one too. But yeah, Boogie Nights, I cannot recommend. This isn't top 10, but it's definitely a top 20 movie for me, like all-time movies, like maybe top 15. Like I love this one.
Yeah, the cast that he assembled is amazing, and clearly for a while Anderson was in love with all of them because they would come back for
a lot of them came back for movies.
Melora Walters, who we only really briefly touched on in this movie, has a tiny part basically as this one of the side characters, and she takes center stage in Magnolia. And we generally don't do this on Film and Water, but we're going to do it for this time. We are going to follow up with the next episode of Film and Water with another Paul Thomas Anderson movie, which is going to be Magnolia, which is the movie he made right after this one. And Ryan, you're going to be joining us for that one as well, correct?
Oh yeah, try and keep me away.
All right, yeah, that is it. And we're going to have another special guest from the network who calls this movie his favorite movie of all time, which is sort of amazing, Magnolia. And there's a whole lot to say about that movie, too. But yeah, Boogie Nights, like you would say, I haven't seen Lars and the Real Girl, but I understand that same thing. When you read the log line, you just go, nah, and you really could be missing something. And so this is just a tremendous, tremendous movie. Obviously, don't watch it with the kids, but it is deeply rewarding, great performances, great music, everything all around. It really is just like a masterpiece. I would just say just an absolute masterpiece. And you know, they've tried to make movies about the porno industry since. There's a movie called Wonderland, which is literally about John Holmes, which is like a Boogie Nights light, essentially, because everybody's trying to catch that heat. They realize that, you know, oh, you can make a movie about this. But Anderson got there, did it right, and you know, it just holds up so, so well. So I said that is going to do it for Boogie Nights. Ryan, where can people find you on our network?
On my podcasts on the network. I've got several. Some of them are on hiatus. Some of them I hope to come back. There might be a future one launching, but you can find me on the network. That's all. The one thing is, this entire time we've been talking, I've been trying to come up with a better porn name than John Penisman. What do you think about Jimmy No Crabs?
That's not so much proactive as it is sort of defensive, really. You know, you're sort of talking about what you're not, as opposed to Dirk Diggler, which really suggests a certain thing. So,
coming up with these names, it's just not in my wheelhouse.
I understand. I appreciate that. So, I always just like Bob Johnson myself. Just seems very simple, very direct to the point. So, anyway,
Harry Pipes.
Exactly. Of course, you can find me on the network. I do a bunch of shows as well. I'll need to go over them all again. Check out Boogie Nights and come back next week with me and Ryan and another guest from the network. We'll be talking about Magnolia. So, until next week, that's a wrap.
Okay, Dirk, you ready?
Yeah, I was born ready, Nick. Let's go, man.
Dirk Diggler demo.
Keep the vocals up.
You got the touch. Take 7. Excuse me, Reed.
You got the touch. You got the power.
think the bass is taken away from the vocal?
No, not really. Maybe. It sounds balanced to me.
It's definitely taken away from my vocal. Just take the bass down and bring up the vocal. Okay, let's do it, Nick. You heard him.